All right, what I thought I would do today is to start with your comments and criticism on the two chapters that you read for today, then go on to my comments and criticism, then go on to a variety of general issues which seems to me are interesting that are suggested by those chapters, and if that doesn't take us through the end of the period, I've got stuff left over from last week we could talk about. All right? So let me start with you. Are there things in that chapter that struck you as wrong or as puzzling or as unconvincing or as worth talking about? The authors are making a very radical claim. They're basically saying that you could abolish copyright law and we'd all be better, almost all of us would be better off, except I guess Walt Disney or Disney stockholders or somebody. And I guess the movie stars, they seem to be down on movie stars too. Are there parts of the argument that seem to you are wrong or that you don't follow or that you want to talk about? Yeah?
The news part, the Modern American newspaper, and they were discussing, he was saying that the having newsboys selling papers on the street would be an innovative business practice that would today be patentable. I don't think that's true. I don't think it would be patentable.
Huh.
Because it would, I think it would fail the test, just like, you know, like novelty or obviousness. I don't think it would be.
When patentable. It was done for the first time?
I don't know that but I don't know that you could, I think it probably was done by, you know, it seems like it's something that would have been done by a lot of people. It would be hard to show that that was...
Well, but his claim, I don't know if he's right.
I don't know.
Neither of us knows the history. But suppose it is true that newspapers were sold in other ways, were sold in newsstands, and that someone is the first entrepreneur to get the idea of having newsboys go down the street saying, you know, terrible battle, thousands slain, see you, read it all here, etc. Why wouldn't that count as a business method?
I think it still might be something that wouldn't be patentable. I think it might be something that might be obvious to somebody in the field to do.
But then the answer, of course, would be, well, if it were obvious, they would have been doing it. Our competitors would have been doing it already, and they weren't.
If it maybe...
Long seen need, all this, what?
Just had to pay the newsboys, maybe they didn't want that cost or something. It might have been something that they had thought about before, but they were trying to, it was cheaper for them to have a newsstand than to actually pay people to physically go out there.
So that would be, I can see that you could certainly make the case as a lawyer for the people charged with infringing when they do it, but it seems to me that a lawyer on the other side could also make the argument on in the other direction that this is, you know, the reason all you people just, you infringers all just imitated it as soon as we started doing it, you saw it worked, so it must have been a great idea that was non-obvious. Or, anyway, that's the argument would have been. Other people's comments? But the general point is an interesting one. The question is, if you try to sort of project current law back in time, do you get good or bad results? And that's sort of part of the argument they're trying to make, is you get bad results. You know? Yes?
Switching chapters, but your analysis of photography, uh-huh. Really, I had issues with it. It seemed like they were interpreting the way that Gawker treated the situation and reacted to the situation as being that's what the court held had to happen.
Yes.
Which I didn't think was a fair analysis. They seemed to say that, well, Gawker said they had to shut down their website and they would no longer be able to host any file sharing. But therefore, that's what the Supreme Court said. But that wasn't at all what the court said. The court said, if you are knowingly hosting illegal copywriting, you can't...
No, they weren't hosting at all.
No.
It's a peer-to-peer sharing system. The argument there is about contributory infringement. The argument there is that they are setting up software which they know other people are going to use to infringe, and they're, in some sense, encouraging them to do so, and that therefore it's contributory infringement. No, that was the difference between them, and I guess it was Napster was the previous one,
okay.
That they didn't have a... Yeah.
The thing is that that's exactly what the press said, is if you knowingly give them the only possible reason is to copy it, then you can't be held vicariously liable. So it was then on the burden of the copyright holders to establish that Gawker was knowingly,
It isn't quite the only possible use, but pretty nearly, yeah. Yes, there was later litigation. There were a couple of other companies that were doing it, and at least I only checked Wikipedia, so I'm sure I'm not an expert on this. But it sounds as though the other companies also went out of business, and I think one of them settled, and I think one of them lost litigation. So what the Supreme Court said basically was, you can sue. This is a case, and you know, I gather what happened to the other ones suggests they would have won. But it did seem to me that he didn't make clear the fact that contributory infringement is a doctrine which does require that the sort of major purpose of what you're doing, of what you're making available, is to infringe. And my guess is it's true. I saw somebody's estimate, at least, that about 90% of what it was being used for was copyrighted stuff. So how they estimated that, I have no idea. But yeah, no. Both chapters are sort of a one-sided polemic. That doesn't necessarily mean they're wrong, though. I mean, that's sort of in. I like enthusiasts in general. I mean, enthusiasts are fun, and they sometimes do interesting things. So I don't think that's a reason to reject it, but it's a reason why one ought to be skeptical of it and critical of it and try to pick holes in it wherever you can. Other people? Yeah?
Well, I like their argument about how, like, the example of open source and how, like, creation can still, innovation stuff can still happen even though there's no IP rights. People are voluntarily giving up their rights. And I just think that that open source movement is huge. Even where I work, we do a lot of stuff with it, and you can still earn a profit if you don't get. So I thought they did a really good job.
The one problem with the argument, I think, is that Microsoft is still in business. That is to say, if open source was a fully adequate substitute for commercial software, there wouldn't be any commercial software because the open source stuff is free and the commercial software isn't. So what that at least suggests is that open source works very well for some kind of software niches, tolerably well for others, less well for others. Which, again, I mean, I think it's very hard to establish the strong claim that they're sort of attacking, which is the world would end if you didn't have copyright. But what's less clear is whether the strong claim they're defending, which is things would be better if you didn't have copyright, is right or not. Because after all, with copyright, you still have open source. And in fact, one point that they never touch on, and which is I was going to raise later, but let me raise it now, what happens to the open source system without copyright law? How much do people know about how open source software works? Yeah?
Oh.
No.
What's your specific question?
Suppose you abolish copyright law. How does that affect the open source movement?
Oh. Yeah, it's kind of huge because the way it works right now is someone agrees that I will give you access to my copyright and you can derive anything you want from my copyright.
Conditional.
Condition that you don't then.
That's right. Opens the copyleft contract. Depends on copyright for its enforcement. Now, whether that's essential, I don't know. People aren't familiar with it. The basic scheme for open source, which really goes back to Stallman's original Free Software Foundation, although he doesn't approve of open source because he has various ideological disagreements with the people in that part of the movement. But the basic idea is we will distribute this source code, which is copyrighted, automatically is copyrighted, and we will license you to use it conditional on your agreeing that if you modify it in any way, you will distribute the modified version only with source code available. All right, so the requirement is that if you use our open stuff, you've got to keep it open. How can they enforce that? Well, they can't really enforce it by contract law very well, because suppose they said, I'm going to give you my source code on condition you agree to those terms, and you agree to the terms. And then you carelessly let him get a copy of the software. He's never agreed to the terms. So he now makes a modified version, compiles it, sells the object code with or without copyright. Now, you could argue that his incentive to pirate it won't be as high without copyright, because now how is he going to make money? But after all, he could use the same kind of model Red Hat uses. He could say, all right, I'm forking this project. I'm going to take the source code for OpenOffice. I'm going to do my improved OpenOffice. I'm going to close it. I'm only going to distribute it as object code, and I'll provide support for it. So even without copyright law, he's going to have a problem because people can make copies of his stuff, but then it's not going to work very well without his help because he's deliberately made it so it needs some support. Clever fellow that he is, or villainous fellow that he is, as we may interpret it. So there is a problem in maintaining the open source system without copyright. Not that it's undoable, but that they will not be able, I think, to prevent people from distributing closed versions, closed forks of their code. Whether that's a problem, I don't know, but I think it is a fact that ought to have been covered at least in the discussion.
So I think it would make people more cautious in terms of disclosing what they come up with, which may end up threatening innovation that the open source movement is, that wants to sort of.
Well, I don't see why open source has to be more careful. That is, they're going to disclose it. They're just going to know that they can't prevent people from forking it. They're just going to rely on the fact that they're going to claim the open version is always better. That after all, how can you trust that closed source software? For all you know, it's taking 10 cents from your online account and giving it to him because he's a clever computer criminal. Whereas our open source stuff, you can see the source code. You see, one of the arguments for open source, basically, in a bunch of contexts, is that because the source code is open, lots of people can look at it. And one version of that, the non-paranoid version of that, is Linus Torvalds' line, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. The idea that you've got a bunch of different programmers who can all read the source code, each of them is interested in different features of it, and the bug that never occurs to me is going to be obvious to you. The paranoid version of that, which is going to get a whole lot more popular now, is with closed source software. How do you know that NSA didn't bribe the producer to put in a backdoor to the encryption built into the software so that they can read the email that you send using Microsoft's email program, which I gather they can. Whereas with the open source version, lots of enthusiastic programmers who don't like the NSA very much are looking at that code and figuring out whether it has any backdoors in it. So that's one of the arguments for open source. And I think Snowden's revelation, I predict, will increase the popularity of open source software for just that reason. Because it's pretty clear that that was one of the things NSA was doing, was bribing people at companies to make their protection weaker in particular ways that NSA could access. Yeah.
Why you couldn't solve that problem if you were the one distributing to the open source sort of movement?
Yeah.
Why you couldn't just do that with some sort of click through agreement?
Because contracts are only enforceable against the people who signed the contract. Think about the more general question of why you can't use contract to substitute for copyright. I publish a book. World Without Copyright. I sell you to the book, and part of the purchase agreement is you agree not to make any copies or to give it to anybody else who make copies. That's contract. Why doesn't that work? It doesn't work because if you violate the contract, deliberately or accidentally, maybe you lose a copy, maybe you just don't believe in keeping contracts. He now has a copy of the book, and he can now make all the copies he's liked not having signed the contract. So now one interesting question, which I don't know enough about to answer, but which I think would be worth thinking about, is whether one could expand the idea, remember what the term is, inducement of breach of contract. I'm not sure. I know that there is a tort of inducing A to breach, of A inducing B to breach his contract with C. And the question is whether there's a way in which you could expand that so that when I sell my book to you, and you carelessly lose it, or you sell it to him. Maybe I'll make you a bad guy, too. You sell it to him without any contractual restriction, that I can sue him on the grounds that the book said in large print, you know, at the beginning, this book is sold under a contract such that all buyers have agreed not to copy it or to give it to sell to anybody else who copies it. He knowingly got you to break that contract, therefore he induced breach, therefore I'm going to sue him for $1 million. But I think it's going to be hard, because what if you just lost the thing, right? That he didn't induce you to breach any contract at all. He never signed any contract, right? What if she stole it from you and sold it to him? Well, she's not bound by the contract. She's broken the law, but she's not bound by the contract. He didn't induce any breach. He didn't even induce stealing. He didn't even know she had stolen it, maybe. All right. So I think the idea of using contract as a substitute for copyright is an intriguing idea. And one of the questions I'd like to put to Bolden and Levine at some point, and probably will, is would they disapprove of using contract to do these things if we had some mechanism for enforcing it? All right. Imagine a technology which makes it practical to actually enforce that click-wrap agreement, so that somehow we can make sure that you can only transmit it to him knowingly and that he is then liable for inducing the breach. Would they approve of that? That is, because in general, sort of pro-free market people like freedom of contract. And I think that's their bias in general. And so it would be interesting to see how that would run into their views on copyright. But I think that is the problem, that basically, of how you... there's a certain sense in which that's the same issue as the difference between contract and property. If you think about the difference between having an easement and having a contract. All right, so you have a piece of land. You sell me the back part of your land with an easement to allow me to cross your land to get to what you sold me. You then sell your land to her. Why should I always pick on the same people? All right, now, if it was only a contractual agreement, then I don't think I'd get access to my land anymore, whereas an easement actually means that you no longer owned that right and therefore could no longer sell it to her, and therefore I've still got it. So really the difference in it, I think conceptually the difference between enforcing restrictions by property and enforcing them by contract has to do with the effect on third parties. The version I used a long time ago in one of my books was to imagine that you are a very, very Orthodox Jew. And you're so Orthodox that not only do you believe that you shouldn't work on Saturday, you believe your car shouldn't work on Saturday either. And you sell your car to somebody who does not share your religious beliefs. But because you have these strong feelings, part of the sales contract is that he agrees not to drive the car on Saturday. Not from sunset Friday to sunset Saturday, to be more precise. And because prior to town clocks in the Renaissance, the day was defined from sunset to sunset. That's why Christmas Eve is the evening before Christmas, not the evening of Christmas. It's never occurred to you why Halloween, which we're coming up on, that's what, 3.5 weeks away. You can tell that by the fact that the decorations are up in the office already. Halloween is the eve of All Hallows' Day, the evening before. So anyway, so you sell the car with this restriction. You can sue him if he drives it on Saturday, but you can't sue the guy he sells it to if he drives it. You can sue him. Maybe he doesn't have any assets. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's left town. You don't know. But the person you sold it to is not constrained. And the only exception to that I can think of with cars is that if you've borrowed money against the car, now you can't get out of that by selling the car to somebody else. That the title is, I think that's right, isn't it? The title of your car is sort of limited by the obligation. I think that's a correct statement. I don't square it is, because I'm not a lawyer like the rest of you. But I think it's right. But in any case, that's in a sense an important conceptual difference between doing things through property, which is what IP is doing, and doing them through contract. Somebody else was... Sorry, we got into a digression. Yes?
Isn't there some kind of workaround to this problem, perhaps licensing the actual product itself rather than selling title to it? In other words, it's almost impossible to purchase title to an electronic good. I feel like in a modern context.
I understand. So I license you my book.
Right.
You now have a copy of my book in your hot little hands.
Right.
You violate the license by photocopying it. You then lose those photocopies, and he, let's pick on a different victim, picks them up, and he then publishes my book.
You'd only be able to sue me.
That's right. You may not have enough assets. That's right. Yeah, no, I was thinking about some of this a long time ago in the software context. It was, you know, imagining, because in software, there are ways in which you might be able to trace the thing. That you can imagine, I sell Microsoft Word, but I customize every copy. Every copy has got hidden in it in some way a code number that tells me what buyer bought that copy, and assuming I've programmed it well enough, you can't take that out without wrecking the program. This is very hard to. So now, when you, having signed the contract agreeing not to resell it, wickedly resell it to him, I'm going to pick a new villain, and he now sells a million copies of Microsoft at half of Word at half my price, I can trace it. As soon as those copies appear, I say, aha, you're the guy, and I can sue you. And you say, well, that's very nice. My total assets are $7,000. You're suing me for $6 million. Sorry, buddy, I don't have the money. And then you go bankrupt, and then he hands you another $100,000 as part of your covert deal now that you've wiped the debt by going bankrupt and so forth. Anyway, because one of the interesting features of the software case is that you can watermark things in principle and maybe even in practice in ways that let you know who it was you sold it to. So, but other people's All right, let me run into a number of, I have sort of a list of things where it seems to me there are problems there. I want to start with the technical economic one, which is one they certainly shouldn't have done being economists. And that's their calculation of the value of the extension of copyright. All right, there, because what they're doing is discounting to present value. So they're saying, all right, if you get a dollar 50 years from now, that's equal to the amount of money that would have added up to a dollar in 50 years at market interest rates. The problem for all the economists out there is that they're using nominal and not real interest rates. All right. Think about first a world with stable prices. In a world with stable prices, the market interest rate is typically 1 to 2%. That's historically the real interest rate. The reason that's not the interest rate you're used to is that you live in a world where prices are generally rising. And if you expect prices to rise at 5% a year, in order to get back as much as you lent in purchasing power, you've got to get at least 5%. And therefore, the market interest rate, the nominal interest rate it's called, will typically be roughly the inflation rate plus the real interest rate. In fact, that's the definition of the real interest rate, but it'll be whatever the real interest rate normally would be plus what people expect the inflation rate to be. They might be wrong. So that means that to do their calculations correctly, you either ought to be assuming constant prices and about a 1 or 2% discount rate, not the 7% discount rate they're using, which point it's still true that 50 years is a long time, but it's not nearly as big an effect as what they're doing. Or you ought to say, well, it's 6 or 7%, but it's in a world with 5% inflation, and therefore the royalties you would have gotten will also be growing at 5% a year. And that gets you back to the same effect as if you'd use the real interest rate. So they are sizably over-discounting. Now, you might argue in the other direction, something they ignore, that most works aren't going to be selling very much in 50 years, and that's true. But, of course, the fact they aren't selling very much also means that having them not on the market doesn't matter very much because nobody wants to read them. So in that sense, it just seems that part of their argument was just wrong. Second point, which they sort of slid over, it seems to me, was the interesting case of the 19th century English authors selling books in the U.S. And what they slid over was the fact that the technology of the time was one in which there was a large fixed cost and a substantial time delay because you were printing books with hand-set lead type. And it's costly in labor and it takes time to set every single letter in a 400-page or 200-page book. Consequently, with the strategy they're describing, I think they've correctly described it. I think they left out one part of it, which I'll get to in a minute. But the strategy is the English author agrees to provide the American publisher the manuscript in advance. The American publisher prints up copies of the book just before the book comes out in England, which is the point at which a pirate can get a hold of a copy in order to pirate it. And sort of the day the book is released, it's released in the U.S., they've got a pile of copies there, so they get all the early sales. And those early sales are then paying them back the fixed cost of buying the manuscript, or paying royalties, whatever they're doing, and setting type and so forth. Now the pirate comes in, whatever it is, 2 weeks or a month later. A lot of the sales are already gone. And furthermore, at this point, what they leave out, the legitimate publisher brings out what's called a fighting edition, which is a really cheap edition, in order to keep the pirate from being able to sell very much, in order that the pirate won't try again next time, basically. Now, I should say, if you want another side of the American publishers pirating British works story, I have added to the syllabus a link to a poem by Rudyard Kipling, which is exactly on that subject. It's quite a lot of fun. It's called The Rime of the Three Captains. It was a result. I actually looked it up because I was pretty sure I knew what was going on just from internal evidence, but I checked online. And an American publisher brought out a volume of, this is when early in Kipling's career, when he sort of just hit London as a prodigy, you know, this whatever he was, 23-year-old or something, star just back from India. And there was an American publisher, I think, had a license to some of his stories that had been published in an American magazine. And they brought out a collection that included those plus a story they had no license to. And if I've got it right, Kipling wrote complaining, and they said, basically, we'll pay you £15 royalty or something for it. And he regarded that as insulting. And so he wrote this wonderful poem, which is about an American pirate, obviously John Paul Jones in context. And Kipling is the captain of a trading bark that's been to India and brought back all these exotic goods, which are his short stories from India. And he's boarded by this evil American pirate who takes all of it, and he then goes to the three great captains in England, who apparently are three major authors we tried to recruit to campaign against American piracy without success, and they say, well, sorry, buddy, he's never bothered us. And to which his reply is, yeah, you know, you're a big ship with lots of guns, of course he doesn't bother you. So it's really a lot of fun. It's quite vicious. It's sort of sadistic when he gets into what he wants to do to that pirate, if he can capture him. But it's fun. So there's a link to it on the syllabus now, and you can read it all for yourself. So that's two contributions that Kipling has made to this course. I think I already told you his line on first mover advantages from a poem, a much better poem, actually, much later and better poem. But anyway, Kipling's a lot of fun. I'm very fond of him. Got one anarchist poem, as well as one poem which gives the anti-Irish independence view of things. It's also it's very good. I mean, it's really good rhetoric, propaganda about the evils of the Irish independence movement and so forth. A question. This isn't really a criticism, something I had wondered about, and I thought you might wonder. At what point did copyright start covering sequels? That is, my impression is that the earliest U.S. copyright was only literal copies. So I'm pretty sure that there were Oz books written by people other than Baum, and I'm wondering whether those were licensed or not. In general, whether sort of the various cases of that sort. Anybody know? There were a number of U.S. sort of children to young adult series, of which one of them is a girl detective, and I forget what the others were, but there were sort of maybe three or four or five or six very popular series which kept running and selling lots of copies, all of which were put out by the same firm. And in fact, all of which were the brainchild of the same guy, although he basically sort of wrote brief sketches and then hired writers to actually write the books. And I was wondering whether somebody could have added another book in that series without his authorization. Because if they could have and didn't, that would be some evidence for the Boulder and Levine thesis that the advantages of the fact that everybody knows that the real whatever she is books are coming out from this publisher. But Tom Swift, I think, was one of his. That's probably the most famous one, if people remember Tom Swift and his amazing this and that. He was sort of scientific genius, teenage kid kind of thing. But then there are a bunch of others as well. But anyway, but you don't know. If you find out, let me know, because I'm curious. In fact, I bet one of my colleagues probably knows, so I can ask him. Another argument of theirs that struck me as less persuasive the more you thought about it was the claim that the extension of copyright kept books off the market because the copyright was held by a major publisher who didn't want to license a reprint of the old book for fear it would compete with the new books. And that struck me as a little implausible because there's no publisher who's anything like a monopoly of the market. So most of the competition will be with other people's new books, whereas all of the revenue from licensing will go to them. So that struck me as somewhat implausible. And after all, the cost of bringing out an old book you have a copyright on is lower than the cost of a new one. Maybe you have to pay royalties depending on the terms of your agreement with the author. You don't have to actually edit the thing and do all the rest of the stuff to bring it out. So that one struck me as sort of pushed substantially. Another one where it seemed to me that they were really more, I don't know, deliberately or not, evading what was going on was this whole issue of compulsory technological protection. That in a sense, they're really sort of dealing with two closely related issues, technological protection and copyright enforcement. And they're closely related in two different ways. One of them is that one of them is a substitute for the other. So that if you can't enforce copyright, that gives you a stronger reason to want to distribute your work in an encrypted fashion that people have to pay you for access to. But also, to some extent, copyright law is used to reinforce tech protection via things like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Incidentally, I have been arguing for some time that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is not actually in force yet, that it cannot come into force until the digital millennium. And as all of the techies here know, a thousand in the computer world is 1,024. It's 2 to the 10th. Consequently, the digital millennium occurs in the year 2048, and until then, the DMCA is obviously not in force. But I don't think I can persuade the courts of that. Maybe Kaczynski I could persuade, but I can think of three federal appeals courts who would appeal judges who would at least think it was a good joke. But of whom I think Kaczynski is one, and I'm sure Danny Boggs would, and I'm sure that Frank Easterbrook would. Those are the three techie federal appeals court judges I happen to know anything about. But I don't think any of them would rule in my favor, unfortunately. But the DMCA is using copyright, like claims to be a copyright law at least, in order to try to support technological protection by making it harder to distribute ways of breaking technological protection. That's sort of roughly speaking what its purpose is. So that's why the two get in a sense, why it's not unreasonable that in their chapters they're talking about both tech protection and copyright. But they are different issues, and you could, you know, one of the interesting questions is, suppose someone comes up with a form of technological protection that really works. All right? Put aside the analog hole, got to have some solution to it, some way, not using copyright law, of allowing the creator to completely control who uses his work. Are they going to be against it or not? Because their argument sounds as though they ought to be against it, and yet I suspect their political principles would say they ought not to be against it. So I'll put that question to Levine at some point shortly. Another point where... Oh, let me go back to what I was saying. The question is, suppose somebody proposes that all computers have to have a chip in them, which makes technological protection practical. I don't know what the proposal was that was actually made, but let me give you sort of my version of it. And that is that every computer has got to have in it a serial number in some form that there's no way of changing. So it's burned into the ROM, and maybe it's inside a little sealed unit, and you never actually see the serial number. It works as an encryption key, and you do a challenge and response. Some people are familiar with this. This is the procedure by which I can prove I have something without ever showing it to you. So suppose I have the key to decrypt messages encrypted with a different... Let me go back a step. Because if we're going to talk about encryption, I really ought to say a little bit about public key encryption, which is sort of was the great breakthrough a few decades ago. Because the ordinary encryption forms, you have a key for scrambling a message and use the same key to unscramble it. And if you're thinking about wanting to be able to send secret messages to people, the problem with that system is that you've got to be able to get the key to the people, but the reason you want to send them secret messages is you're afraid that people are bugging your communication channels. So if I don't have a messenger I can trust to get my secret message to you, how do I have a messenger I can trust to get my key to you without taking a copy which he can then use to secretly spy on us? All right, that's the problem. Solution to this problem is something called public key encryption, which consists of a mathematical process that generates a pair of keys, each of which acts as the inverse of the other. That is to say, if I have key A and I encrypt a message with key A won't decrypt it. Key B will decrypt what key A encrypts. Key A will decrypt what key B encrypts. All right? That makes sense? I say it again if it doesn't. This is stuff you really want to know if you're going to live in Silicon Valley, because it was one of the great inventions of the last 50 years. Because it's not clear what the effects are going to be, but it has the potential to give you a world with very, very high levels of privacy, higher than we've ever had. And you know, whether that actually happens depends on all sorts of things, among other things, whether people care about privacy. But so let me try it again. We create a pair of numbers. They're numbers, long numbers, pair of numbers, and there's a mathematical process by which you plug a message and number A in, and it comes out with a scrambled version of that message. If you had infinite time, you could decrypt it with A by scrambling every possible message with A until you got a match. If you think of a message of any size, you have to have a lot of candles because the sun's going to burn out before you're finished. All right. However, key B, which you produced with the mathematical process that produced key A generated key B at the same time. So you're sort of randomly generating a pair of keys which have a certain mathematical relationship to each other, such that it isn't practical from one of them to deduce the other. But what is scrambled with A is unscrambled with B, and what's scrambled with B is unscrambled with A. Why is this useful? I roll up such a pair of keys. I then make one of them public. I not only send it to you, I print it in the newspaper, I put it on a billboard. Everybody, all the spies are welcome to my public key. Because what you use my public key for is to encrypt the messages you send to me. I, who still have my, I'm the only person in the world with my private key, so only I can decrypt those messages. If he has my public key, he can see I send me secret messages too. All right? So that's the guts of how you can have a system where everybody can send messages to everybody else that no third party can intercept. Now, in practice, there are all sorts of problems. You've got to make sure your private key is really private. You've got to make sure that when you rolled up those keys, it was with reliable software and that the software didn't deliberately bug it in some way so that the NSA can spy on you. But it does mean that potentially you can have, if you have a sort of a functioning, fully implemented public key infrastructure, it means that you have a world where anybody can send a message to anybody that no third person can read. It also means, it gets you a second benefit, that you can prove who you are. Because after all I have to do to prove a message came from me is to encrypt it with my private key. Plus a note unencrypted saying who it's from. You now take my public key, which all the world knows, you decrypt it. When it turns out it's not gibberish, you know it was encrypted with a matching private key. Only I have the matching private key, therefore it was from me. And that's the guts of how digital signatures work, although they are more elaborate. Practical system. But so that's a very interesting technology.
So can you make it so that a private key can be generated from either? So let's say you're hosting this or you create the product, but you want to ensure that, you want to tell the consumers that actually we can, you know, but our company can't use Dropbox either, so we're having their software generate this.
So if I don't want to be able to eavesdrop on you, that means that you have to have generated a public key, private key pair, which I had never got my hands on, and you kept the private key all to yourself.
Right. And so you can sell this program to others, but the person who created the program doesn't actually know the actual key.
That is, you'd have to have it in such a way that you use your private key along with my program. But what I was thinking of in terms of putting a chip in, suppose you're Congress, right? You've got an unlimited ability to make people do stuff. Congress likes to think it does. And so what we do is the following. We get some innovative Silicon Valley company to design a little chunk of hard plastic made so that if you try to open it up, you'll destroy it. How we do that, I'm not sure, but suppose we can do it. What's inside it? Inside it is a little tiny computer and a private key. And that private key is different for each piece of plastic. And for each piece of plastic, we, in making it, keep a record of the public key, not of the private key. That's just inside this thing. And the way this little computer is made is that if I encrypt a message with the public key and send it to this little computer inside my little plastic chip, it will decrypt the message and send it back. Why is this useful? This is what's called challenge and response. Because what this now means is that in order to prove that this is the chip in your computer, because I only license Microsoft Word to you, let me explain. All right, now that we've got this chip in every machine, in order to prove that it's running on your computer, Microsoft Word generates a random message, sends it to the little chip in your machine, encrypts it with the public key that's supposed to match with the private key inside your little plastic chunk, sends it to your plastic chunk, gets back the translated version, checks the translated version is right, and says, aha, it really is the machine of the guy we licensed the program. Does that make sense? Yes? No? No. People are still confused. It's getting too complicated. What I'm describing is how, if you could solve a technical problem you may or may not be able to solve, which is the problem of how to make a chip that can't be accessed. See, if I can disassemble that chip, I can then read out the private key in it, make 10,000 copies, and when I sell my pirated copy of Word, I sell with each pirated copy one copy of you of the chip that's got your private got my private key. I'm the one who bought it from my... This is now a world without copyright enforcement. We're trying to use technological protection to replace copyright. Congress is helping us. If I can buy one copy of Microsoft Word and get one thing in my, and have it customized to my machine, if I can then break into my own machine and get out its private key, I can then make copies for everybody else. All right. So it requires tamper-proof technology, which you may or may not be able to do, but it's not obviously impossible. But with that, you could then put that chip in every machine, and now every machine has an ID, an unforgeable ID number. Right. The reason we've got to do it in these fancy ways is that if we do it in any simple way, then a good software programmer can modify his machine to pretend to have a serial number that's not a serial number. All right. If you imagine, well, I wasn't doing anything as fancy as I described. Suppose all it is it's just a serial number hardwired in each machine different, which I think there may be actually at present. But then a programmer could set it up so that when Microsoft Word asked the machine, what's your serial number, the machine lied to it. You intercept the message, give the number which matches the pirated copy of Word. So that's why you need this kind of fancy stuff I'm describing. But the basic point I'm making is that it's not absurd to think that you might be able to modify all computers in such a way that each of them had a unique ID that could be checked. And if you did that, then you could, in principle, replace copyright law with a licensing scheme in which the licensing is self-enforced by the software itself. The software is designed to only do it. It's not easy, because you've got to prevent a clever person from taking the copy of Microsoft Word that's licensed to him and modifying it in such a way that it no longer checks, that it always says, yes, I got a positive result. So not a trivial problem, but I'm only suggesting that trying to give some feel for why people who wanted to enforce their copyrights via technological protection might want Congress to mandate things. Now, there is a possible response to that, which they actually should have discussed and didn't, and that is that when I am arguing in favor of the computer manufacturers why we shouldn't have to do this, I'm going to say to the Microsoft representative, well, that's just fine. Design all this technology and give us the option of including your chip in our machine if we want. And if your software is so great, people only buy machines with the chip in it, because your software won't run on any machine that doesn't have the chip. And if it's not so great, well, tough luck. So that's easy response. They ought to have offered and didn't. And I will suggest that to them too for their next edition or something. But the basic argument, going back a bit, my complaint about their argument on this whole idea of requiring DVD players or computers have some special feature is that they're putting it as if the reason to require it is so that somebody other than the software manufacturer has to bear the cost. But the truth is that the reason to require it is they don't want machines out there without this restriction, because those machines can then be used to play stuff that isn't authorized to play. All right. The point of all of these restrictions is some way in which the content creator can control who uses the content. And it's not just copyright right enforcement. I should say one of the major things you're trying to do is price discrimination. So as you may know, I don't know is too strong because I'm not an expert on this, but I believe it is the case currently that DVD of movies, maybe of music, I'm not sure, come with a region code. So the DVD says this DVD is supposed to be played in North America. And at least in theory, your DVD player knows it was sold in North America, and therefore it will play the North American version, but not the Japanese version or the South American version. And it's far from a perfect system, because you could, after all, if you really wanted to play the South American version, get a friend in Brazil to buy you a DVD player and mail it to you or something, but that would be a nuisance. So the theory of it, at least, is that the producer of the movie says, well, look, Americans are rich. They're willing to pay $10 for my DVD. Brazilians are much poorer. They're willing to pay $3. Cost me $1 to produce each DVD. Why shouldn't I sell it to both of them? So I will have the South American version at a cheap price, the U.S. version at an expensive price. All right, that's the same mechanism that book publishers sometimes use when they publish a edition of a book which is not to be sold outside of the U.S., only sold outside of the U.K. So just an attempt, how successful one doesn't know, to enforce price discrimination. Maybe good or bad, but that's just, I'm just trying to explain what's going on. I don't think ever discusses that. That's another point. Let me make a couple of notes for the authors for next time. Right. Because, see, the argument they could make for the voluntary chip is, look, if it's really true that copyright protection is important, then Microsoft will be able to produce much better products than the competitors who've got to face pirates, and then people will want the chip in their machines so that they can play the Microsoft software, therefore. So that would actually be a pretty good argument for them, so they ought to use it. Anyway, let me go on. Let me take another one which struck me as pretty dubious. And the quote was that the media, the people who were trying to get things like the DMCA passed, and in particular the digital media from which they earned no revenue at all 20 years earlier, are especially prone to piracy. So the implication of what Boulder and Levine is saying is, isn't it unfair for these media companies to want to make sure they can make money selling digital media when before 20 years ago they didn't even exist? But the answer, of course, is yeah, but now that it exists, it's competing with the non-digital media. They don't have the option of saying, you can pirate the e-book all you like, we don't care, we're selling the printed books, because people buy the e-book instead. And you don't have the option of saying, we're selling, going into the movie theater and watching the movie, we don't care that you can pirate our DVD, because people use the DVD instead. So I thought that argument was a little disingenuous, in my view at least. Another point which is sort of interesting, and where they're a little unclear, but and that's the question of video game machines. Because video game machines do roughly the equivalent of what I was describing with that chip, and they do it voluntarily. That is to say, a company brings out a video game machine. They try to make it in such a way that only games they have authorized will play on it. A further thing they try to do, which I'm not sure why they try to do, is to prevent people from creating add-ons to the machine that will let you cheat on the games. All right, this was a real issue, that you've got a video game machine, and then some clever person writes something you can plug into the machine which will let you automatically give your character 10,000 experience points or something, or jump levels or do all sorts of things. Now, my initial reaction is, why should you object to that? I mean, I object to it on aesthetic grounds. You know, it's wrong that you should be able to get to 100th level without having worked hard the way I had to work to get to 23rd level. But as far as the manufacturer, if customers want it, why should they object to someone else making an add-on that lets them have more fun with it? But maybe the answer is that they figured that their customers liked showing off to each other how high a level they'd reached, and that wasn't work anymore when you can cheat. Yeah.
Or they want to sell their own chunk device.
Yeah, but they weren't. I mean, it would have made sense if they were. But in any case, so the particular case I know about, and I actually don't remember how the case finally turned out, was sort of, I thought it was a really very neat case. What they do is they have in their machine a non-encrypted challenge and response kind of thing. That is something where in order for the machine to play a cartridge, I think it was, or maybe it played to work with the add-on, I don't remember whether this was controlling non-authorized games or controlling the add-on, but I think it was the add-on. It's got to be able to play a certain string of text, like, you know, three sentences. Well, that's easy enough. I find out what the three sentences are and put it into my, but now I'm violating your copyright. Because your three sentences are copyrighted, not of any use to anybody. Their only purpose is to function as the key in a lock. All right, and that was at least their claim, and I'm not sure if they succeeded in winning it. But more generally, you can see that the video game machines are to a significant extent relying on copyright, because copyright is what prevents cheap competitors, from simply burning copies of their ROMs and building their own machines without all the research costs. And that the initial cases on whether or not software was copyrightable before Congress explicitly said it was, were clone cases. They were, at least the ones I knew about, was Franklin v. Apple, where the Apple II was a successful computer. Franklin built a clone of the Apple II, and in order to do so, they had to copy the ROMs of the Apple II, and their view was that's not a writing, it's not covered by copyright. Apple said it was, and that went through litigation. Now, I should say my first computer was a clone of the TRS-80, which was the other most popular home computer. And I don't know how they did it. I don't think there was any litigation, and it may be the TRS-80 didn't have any copyrighted stuff on it, because the TRS-80 operating system, you loaded off a disk. And in fact, that was a really interesting case, actually, because there was a competitive market for operating systems. There were about four or five different companies producing operating systems for the same machine. And if I remember correctly, when Radio Shack brought out either the Model 3 or the Model 4, it wouldn't run on its own operating system. They had done a bad job of modifying their operating system to fit their new machine, and I believe they ended up pirating one of the third-party operating systems and getting into trouble, and then I think they bought it eventually, if I remember correctly. I think LDOS, if I remember correctly. But that was fun, because I was using DOS Plus, which was one of the third-party ones, was clearly better than TrisDOS, which was the original one, which I could have bought from, because my machine wouldn't have come with it, but I could have bought it from Radio Shack. But this was an LNW80, and for the techies in the room, it ran at a blazingly fast 4 megahertz, back when the TRS-80 ran at 2 megahertz. It was a nice machine. It's still in my basement somewhere, and I'm very fond of it, because that was my first word processor. When I first encountered word processors, when I was teaching at UC Irvine for a quarter, and they had a Wang word processing system, and the way it was a dedicated word processor, and the system was the professor typed up his article or book or whatever, and he gave it to the word processor ladies, and they retyped it into the word processor, and then they printed it out and he corrected it, and they typed in the corrections. I may have told you the story already, but my conclusion was that the word processor ladies had negative productivity, because it's easier to do your original typing on a word processor, as all of you know, than on a typewriter. So I decided I needed a word processor, and it turned out, with a little research, that the cost of a dedicated word processor was about the same as the cost of a computer that ran a word processing program, and the computer could do other things as well. So that's why I first got a home computer, God, 30 years ago? More than that. Back in the days when the TRS-80 and the Apple II were the main home computers that existed, back before the IBM PC came out, I think, by a little bit. And back when the nearest thing to a laptop a little bit after that, when the IBM PC was something like Compaq, which must have weighed, God, 15 pounds. It was a sewing machine, roughly, if you know what a sewing machine is like. But you could carry it and you could... I don't think it folded open, but the keyboard came off and you could see the screen, if I remember correctly. It's a pretty good machine. Anyway, so let's... One of the issues that the article at least raises is they make the point that software was very successful and innovative at a time when it wasn't protected by patent and when it wasn't protected by broad copyright, but it was protected by narrow copyright. That is, it was the case that it was illegal for you to make lots of copies of somebody else's program and sell them in a store. You could in practice make copies and give them to your friends, so it wasn't a perfectly enforceable copyright. That's the usual digital problem. There were attempts to do copy protection. My favorite story from that is that there was some disks were distributed that were made in various fairly simple ways to be hard to copy. And there was a program called Super Utility Plus, which did a whole lot of useful things for TRS-80 machines, one of which was copying copy-protected disks. So, contributory infringement? Maybe. You could argue that giving it that feature was. But, in fact, it was, however, copy-protected against itself. Another company brought out a program called Data Doubler whose sole purpose in life was to copy Super Utility Plus. And that surely was contributory infringement, but they deserved it given that they were producing software to copy everybody else's stuff. So, those were just to tell you a little bit of sort of the ancient history of Silicon Valley and that world, which was an exciting time back then. But this does raise... So the problem for Bolden and Levine is they want to argue that with no copyright at all it would have happened. And the argument for that is open source. And the argument against it is, as I said earlier, the fact that commercial software successfully competes with open source, which suggests that for some purposes it's better. So that, it seems to me, suggests at least that they're overstating their case and that there were real advantages to at least narrow copyright, whether or not, even though you would have had something even without it, which I think is true. And this raises one of the questions that intrigues me about this, which is whether the real solution to all of this stuff isn't abolishing copyright but cutting it down. Whether if you said, look, the problems come If you look at most of the stuff people are complaining about with regard to copyright, it's, I can't use a little bit of your tune in my movie. I've got to get permission to quote a paragraph of your book and so forth. So suppose you redo, take copyright law back to its origin, as it were, and you say anything which amounts to making something that's a reasonably clear copy of my work directly competing with it violates my copyright, anything else is all right. You want to translate, fine. If I cared about a translation, I would have gotten the translation done and copyrighted too. You want to parody, fine. You want to do a sequel, fine. And sort of my instinct as an author is that it doesn't matter very much, that I do have a fair number of my books have been translated, but it isn't a very major revenue source. And, you know, certainly I'd be happy to give permission to translate for free for any language that isn't being translated for paying me. So I may have told you, I've got this daydream about making a fortune out of the translation of one of my books into Chinese because of the fact that the translation into the version of Chinese that sells in Taiwan only, which is the complicated characters, sold more copies per capita than the original book did in English, so I was told. And it has been translated into simplified characters. So if only I can collect royalties, and if only the per capita rate in the mainland is as high as it was in Taiwan, I could make a lot of money. But I don't think it's going to happen, alas. I am hoping at some point, though, to get a trip to China out of that. Go give some talks about my book. I haven't been to mainland China except Hong Kong, and it's obviously a fascinating place at the moment, which I want to visit. Anyway, so... Now, it's true novelists like the idea of movie rights, but my guess is that the actual fraction of novelist income that comes from movie rights is not very large, so I don't think that's too plausible. Now, one interesting question is, if you had my narrow copyright, how do you apply it to software? All right? Because if you think about how software works, there are lots of things that are really copying that aren't literal copying. So if you take the very simplest version, which is we decompile your object code, which means you turn it back into source code, which you can do with some difficulty. We then recompile it with a different compiler. We now have what ought to be functioning. We've done a good job functioning an identical program, but bit by bit it's entirely different. So I think you would have... But what you might want to do then is to say, look, copyright law doesn't protect against independent invention. So therefore, I will do some equivalent of putting bogus stuff on a map. I will embed some stuff in my program which is not functional, but which I can prove demonstrates that your program was gotten from mine, and we'll then have stronger rules for that than we do for... Yeah.
I would imagine that companies act like it's narrow copyright.
Well, except for the case of Lotus v. Borland, which was discussed in the book, since the protagonist of one side of that was one of the authors of one of the readings in your book, namely Mitch Kapoor, and there it was perfectly clear that Borland had not copied the code. What Borland had borrowed was the structure of commands for controlling the spreadsheet. And Lotus held that that was a copyright infringement. And that was, arguable. It was a 4-4 split on the Supreme Court when the case got to them. So you can claim, people do try to claim under current copyright law, that the copyright covers not just the code, but the structure of the program in some sense.
I mean, companies might want to do things like add in the kind of the, well, you know, when you're making a map, yes, of errors. Because it's easier to win on narrow copyright, and you don't have to get into court and have this risky litigation.
It might be. They might make sense. Wrong or they do, I don't know. I am told that people who do maps do that, and people who do encyclopedias do versions of seeding it with false stuff in order that you can prove something was copied. But I was then thinking, going on, about the same kind of issues with regard to bans, all right? Because, again, if you look at the Boulder and Levine argument, there's really a bit of a problem, because they go through how little money bands get out of the copyrighted music and how they get their money mostly from concerts. But, of course, it's not like bands are compelled to copyright their music. All right, there is nothing preventing a band doing original stuff from doing what he's talking about, produce it yourself on your home computer, or maybe spend some money on getting a studio to do a better job, distribute it for free online, and then give concerts. And I My guess is there are probably bands that do that. But if there's nothing stopping it, then presumably the fact that bands do sign up with major labels must mean they believe they make money, more money doing that. And that therefore his implication that the benefit of the copyright is only going to the publisher and not to the artist almost certainly has to be wrong. Now, it might be true that not very much benefit goes to the artist, that it's enough so it's worth the artist, many artists doing it, that they're getting promotion from the label and a little bit of money, and then they get their concerts. Then maybe that's the form of the deal. But it's got to be worth something. So I think the argument that they've got to be have to make if they want to really defend their claim that music would be better off without copyright is that music would be a little worse off from the direct effect, but then there's the indirect effect that people who want to use other people's music as an input to their music, or people who want to make movies with scraps of music in it, are stopped from doing so by copyright law, and that the gain in that would be larger. I think that's the argument they've got that they ought to be making if they wanted to try to make the argument. And that again then suggests, well, maybe the answer is narrow copyright. Maybe the answer is that we should say that if you actually reproduce my music, I can sue you, but if all you do is to reproduce 4 seconds of my music in your film, that's all right, and it's not covered. That might be a plausible way. I was also a little bit struck by the line, because all the wonderful old music is under copyright at least until the 22nd century, because I'm pretty sure that Bach and Beethoven are not covered by a copyright, given that they are quite a lot more than 200 years ago. But anyway... I wanted to say a little bit about Bain Books, which they touch on a little bit, which is actually an even more interesting story than they make it out. And I'm familiar with the story because they published my first novel for me, so I admire of it. And Jim Bain, who was the founder of Bain Books, is no longer alive, unfortunately, was the one publisher I know of who saw the Internet as an opportunity rather than a threat. And he did a bunch of different things. One of them was to sell electronic versions of his books without any protection, unencrypted, and presumably his view was that the amount you would lose by copying wasn't enough to make up for the inconvenience to customers of having it in encrypted form. And they quote Eric Flint, who's one of their authors, and Eric is quoting David Drake, who's another one of their authors, is basically saying that Bain was the only publisher who you actually made any money from your electronic books. And that's consistent with my experience. I don't remember what the numbers were, but of my total royalties, which weren't very large, it wasn't a very successful novel, a significant fraction were actually from e-book sales. So that fits their story. But in addition to that, Bain does 3 other things, which he doesn't discuss. One of them is the Bain Free Library, and that is that they take books of theirs, especially books that are the early books in series that are still coming out, and that they aren't selling many copies of anymore, and they put them up online for free. All right? This, you know, it's sort of like the story one is always told, which I'm not sure I believe, about the heroin pushers who give you a free shot and get you addicted. Well, they're getting you addicted to the David Drake series or somebody else's series of novels by letting you read the download for free the first one, and then if you want the want to know what happens after the 3rd or 4th story, you got to start paying them. So, which I thought was sort of clever. Second thing they do, which I may have mentioned before, is a really neat piece of discriminatory pricing, and that is that there is something called an ARC, an ARC, an author's review copy, which publishers normally produce as a sort of a not quite finished editing, so it's still got a few flaws, and it's on cheap paper, and it's sent out to reviewers in order that when you publish the book, the reviewers have already read it, and your reviewers will come out when the book comes out. And so Bain produces an e-ARC. This is an electronic version of an author's review copy, but it's not for reviewers. It's to be sold. And the idea is this book, which is the next book in this series that you're enthusiastic, and you and all your friends are enthusiastic readers of, and the book is coming out on February 1st. But if you pay us a little extra, you can find out what happens on January 1st. And if you pay us a little bit more extra, you can find out what happens on December 1st, because that's where we start releasing the e-ARC at a price which then falls over time as we get to the final one. So that was another very clever use of it. And the final one is that Bain developed what's, in an odd sense, a sort of an open source model for authorship. And this is actually, the version of it I know actually involves Eric Flint, who's quoted in this book, who's an interesting guy. And Eric Flint wrote a book called 1630. Anybody here read 1630? recommend it. It's a pretty good story. It's sort of the up-to-date version of the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, if any of you have read or heard of that. It's the story in which modern people somehow find themselves back in time. And in 1630, it's not just one modern person. It's a whole West Virginia mining town with a bit of the surrounding landscape, a sort of a sphere, picks up everything in a sphere that's, I suppose, 10 miles across, something like that, and dumps it in the middle of Germany in the middle of the 30 Years' War, 1630. And there's a little bit of sort of a suggestion of how it happened due to a passing alien spaceship that did something by accident, but that isn't really important. The important thing is, having set up the story, all right, you've got this town of modern Americans dumped in the middle of the 30 Years' War. What do they do? And it's really, it's quite a good book. The first book is good. Second one is pretty good. The later ones are not as good, which I'll get to in a minute, because how they develop is sort of interesting. But it's a lot of fun, and part of it is just being intelligent about recognizing that the people in the 17th century weren't stupid. So that after not very long, some of them realize what's going on, and they start offering high prices to smuggle books out of the library to them, so that they can find out both about modern technology and about the future. Of course, the future is going to change, because the existence of this town is going to change it. So you get the King of England, who is not very bright, hunts up a harmless country squire by the name of Oliver Cromwell and locks him up, because Oliver Cromwell, 10 years later, is going to be the general who wins this English Civil War for the Parliamentary side. And meanwhile, Richelieu, who is smart, bribes the King of England to transfer England's claims in the New World to France, because he realizes from reading the history books that the New World is going to be really important. He wants it to be French. So it's a lot of fun anyway. One of the other fun things is going on, and which is really interesting, and which reflects Flint's politics, some of which I agree with, even though he probably would describe himself as a Trotskyite or socialist or something, is the question of how the people in this town are going to interact with the other people around them. They get immigrants in, and the question is, do they set themselves up as a permanent aristocracy of the 20th century people who are going to run the government and everything and will accept the other alien as second-class citizens? Or do they say, wait a minute, we've got this really great technology to introduce to you. It's called democracy. And we can subvert your political system with it, which is Flint's theory, at least, of what's happening. So that part is really interesting. But getting back to what's relevant to this course, as opposed to why it's a fun book, what Bain did was to set up on their website a conversation about what people in that situation could do. A conversation about things like, all right, you've got some great powers that are trying to crush you. This is partly a naval war. Given the very limited resources these people have, what can they build? And in fact, the answer ended up, you duplicate American Civil War ships, because you've got enough to build them and you couldn't build a modern warship. How about airplanes? Well, there's no way they're going to build an internal combustion engine, but they've got some internal combustion engines. So some enthusiast, probably 22-year-old enthusiasts, take apart an old VW Bug and build a small plane. But a lot of that is coming. Eric Flint doesn't know enough to have written those books. All right, he knew enough to write the first one, which doesn't have as much of this. So he is getting a whole bunch of open source contributors who are enthusiasts of things like Civil War naval stuff, and I'm sure homemade airplanes and other things, to engage in a conversation. Some of them write stories. That is, some of the later volumes in this series are collections of stories written by other authors, but set in his world and his future. So it's really quite an interesting example of something rather like an open source process being applied to the creation of literature by Bain. Anyway. And I'm not sure if Walter and Levine know about that part of it, but it's fun and interesting and relevant to what they're doing. I got too much to talk about, actually, it turns out. Let me raise one of the things that came up in passing that I thought was intriguing, and that was the question of copyright and leaked emails. All right? So they tell the story of how the company that's producing closed-source voting machines somebody somehow gets at a bunch of their internal correspondence pointing out that there are problems with these machines that might let somebody to hack into them and do vote fraud, and it gets published. And the company, it seems to me legally on very pretty strong ground, says, wait a minute, this is all copyrighted stuff. You're violating our copyright. You're putting it up on the web. We're going to go to Swarthmore, which is the because these were students at Swarthmore, and make you take it down. And they initially did, and then various other things happen. But the question is it legitimate or not legitimate to use copyright law to prevent the dissemination of private information of general interest? See, this isn't the only such case, because the case that it immediately reminds me of is ClimateGate. I don't know if any of you followed it, but ClimateGate was the same story, except that it was a climate research place in the UK, and somebody managed to get into their system and download a whole lot of emails, some of which at least arguably showed them behaving in a irresponsible fashion, showed them deliberately not releasing information about the data their results were based on that they were legally obliged to do on various excuses, talking about, you know, I won't go into the details. You can argue that the problem with knowing whether it's really good evidence against climate stuff is that if you have, you know, 10,000 emails and you go through them, you can almost certainly find something that will make some of the authors look bad, whether they should or not. But at least its actual effect was that it weakened public support for action to deal with global warming because there was stuff in there which at least made it look as though some of the scientists involved were behaving unethically. Should they be able to prevent the distribution of information? You can read it. I mean, it's up there. At least it was up. I assume it's still up, the collection of emails. I glanced at it briefly at one point. Should you be able to use copyright to prevent that? Any opinion? It's the same case, just absolutely politically on a different side. Nobody?
Wouldn't it be more appropriate, though, it's like a criminal thing, violation, or somebody is...
Except that you don't know who got it out. That is what happens is person A gets into it. Person A doesn't want to get into trouble. So he arranges to have the whole thing put up on a public server somewhere, not linked to him. B, C, D, E, and F download it. They've broken copyright law, but they've broken no computer intrusion laws, and they then put it up again. So that's why copyright law is, in a sense, the appropriate way to stop it. If it should be stopped, but you can obviously argue it shouldn't be stopped. So, all right. I'll let people think about that one. But it just struck me looking at that it's a more general issue. Yo?
So what happens in the Swarthmore case?
What happens in the Swarthmore case is that bad PR eventually got the voting machine company to drop their insistence on taking it down. I think it was taken down and then put back up again. At least I'm just judging by what Baldwin and Levine said. I don't know the story, but I'm pretty sure I remember that their account was that the first thing that happens is the voting machine company basically goes to Swarthmore, and I don't know if it was a takedown notice or how they did it, probably takedown notice, and Swarthmore agreed to take it down. And the students kept, I guess, publicizing it in some fashion, and eventually, for PR reasons, the voting machine company backed down.
I never really actually understood the point of using copyright to protect private communication. I thought that was, maybe it's one of those things where when you draw the boundaries, you just have to put it in because it's hard to find. Mm-hmm. But it really doesn't relate to the purpose. Because it seems more like you're protecting privacy. It doesn't seem to relate to the purpose of copyright.
The only place where it would seem to relate is if the private things might eventually be published for royalties. So that if you imagine the case where my correspondent, I'm some important political figure, and my correspondence is private now, but eventually, and I think there was a case involving, I think maybe the first Bush, if I remember correctly, where he had a memoir that was coming out, and somebody got access to a fairly small chunk, but it was really important. That might be right. I don't remember, but it was something like that. So you can certainly imagine those cases. But I agree that in general it does seem as though it's being used for a very different purpose. But then in the case where it was being used by the video game people to prevent other people from using it from interfacing with their video game, it was being used for, it had nothing to do with it wasn't that they wanted an incentive to write strings of words that you could use as keys for getting into their machine. It was But once you have a law, that's going to happen pretty naturally. All right, well, we're just about out of time. Let me mention the two points that I thought would be worth discussing, and you can discuss them among yourselves or think about them, maybe we'll talk about them next time or something. And one of them is, with a given current technology, could one make copyright enforceable, and what would you have to do it? All right, imagine for a moment that you are persuaded that Boulder and Levine are wrong, that you're persuaded it is really important that books and movies and songs and such be protectable. They copyright, what would you have to do, technologically, legally, whatever, in order to enforce it? And the parallel question about technological enforcement. Suppose you say, all right, can't enforce it legally. We want to use technological enforcement to get the equivalent of copyright. What would you have to do technologically and legally to do it? So I think that's an interesting question, and it's one I've been interested in for a long time. I was interested in technological protection back before it was fashionable and before the current stuff was there. So you might think about for yourself that is an interesting puzzle, and then we'll talk about the next day, maybe some more of this stuff, but also about our next set of reading. Thursday, and we've always got things in reserve if we end up with time that we want to spend.